You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince, in for Mindy Todd. Today, August 1st, is the 200th birthday of Herman Melville. Historian Greg Williams and pianist Jacqueline Schwab have planned a party to celebrate, which they're calling Happy 200th Birthday, Herman Melville, Beyond the Wail, a recitation with piano. Greg Williams and Jacqueline Schwab, welcome. Great to have you back.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us is Marianne Agresti. She's the president of the Yarmouth New Church Preservation Foundation, and she is here because the recitation is taking place at the new church. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Greg and Jacqueline, this will be your third collaboration, I think.
Fourth.
Fourth. Oh my goodness. Combining history and music. Your previous collaborations have focused on World War I and the armistice, to name a few. How do you come up with topics? How does that happen?
Well, the World War I was, as I said before, that one was something that I had wanted to do. And then when the centennial of the war went by last year, Jacqueline and I were sitting around, and she said, "Well, we ought to come up with something else." And right away in my mind came Melville, and I'm not really sure why. There is a bit of a Cape tie that we'll probably get into with Melville. I didn't know at the time that this year was the bicentennial of his birth, so that's really worked out perfectly. And even more perfectly, today, August 1st, is the birthday itself, and we were able to have it at the new church, which is something we're both very excited about.
And I would just add that in our work together, I think we both enjoy taking a historical topic and making it current, just finding the relevance of that topic and proclaiming it in modern sense. My arrangements tend to try to have some period feel to them and also some modern feel. And Greg, who just really does a lot of research, often finds amazing quotes that still are just potent today.
And Marianne, tell us more about the new church and why this is such a great venue for this type of performance.
Well, the new church is a very unique building. It's located on 6A in Yarmouthport. Some people might know where the Gorey House is, and it's across the street from the Gorey House and Museum. It was built in 1870 as a Swedenborgian church. Swedenborgian is a religion that combines naturalism and Christianity. The church was very popular, and it was built in 1870. There were 350 people actually attended at the time. But over many decades, the building fell into disrepair. In 1998, a group of local citizens, several of which had been descendants of the original congregants, formed the Preservation Foundation that we run and saved the building. We've rebuilt the steeple. We have restored all the interior paintings and the ceiling. The building is built in the American Gothic tradition, so unlike a lot of churches that you see in the Cape, it's actually quite decorative inside, and it's a huge surprise when people walk in. They always kind of catches their breath. We have the original organ in there from 1870. So for this program, it's a perfect match because the acoustics are impeccable. The decoration is incredibly unique, and since 1998, we have been working as volunteers to make this into a cultural destination for the North Side.
Before we went on the air, you showed me a photo, an online photo of the interior of the church, and it's striking. I almost thought it was sort of like a timber frame design. There's gorgeous wood. It's almost like a wooden frame.
It is. It's all carved wood. The entire building is wood frame. And what you saw in that photo was a lot of it exposed with very unique, colorful plaster paintings between.
Beautiful. Yeah. And Jacqueline, have you played in that space before?
I did. I performed a program of music of Mark Twain's era.
And how would you describe the acoustics?
Well, I enjoyed it.
And it sounds like there's always, one of my questions was, does Greg ever come up with a topic and you think to yourself, oh boy, we're never going to have music to that? Or is it the opposite
that
where
was
you
Melville,
say,
I think.
Like your brain starts churning and then suddenly you almost have too much music because you really start feeling those connections?
I would say yes, both of those things. Exactly. You nailed it.
Yeah. When you're pulling together music, what are some of the things you're considering? Is it time period? You were talking about making history more relevant. Is it modern day? Just give us a little window into how you make the selections.
Well, we looked at a broad swath of timely music. So 1819 to, what is it, 1891?
1891.
With maybe a few years on either end. We looked at classical music. But then we really turned our attention to an area that I've especially know well, which is I've explored 19th century parlor music. And in the 19th century, there wasn't a sharp definition between classical and folk, and it was just music. But the scary part was Melville's time in Polynesia. But we can, maybe we'll get to that.
Well, anyway. we do have a song to start. This is titled "My Joe" by John Anderson. Tell us more about this piece and why you chose it.
It comes from Robert Burns, beloved Scottish poet, who was a man of the people, really, who trumpeted the common person, which is unusual in the 18th century, and his music was still widely loved in America in the 19th century, so it seemed to connect to our topic really well. And I'll mention that at our concert, I won't be playing this particular piece, but I'll be playing Scottish airs from a Scottish air from the period, some Scottish dance tunes of livelier, and also a wonderful ballad, Sir Patrick Spens, that Greg has found a reference to, that Melville mentioned that ballad and knew well of it. And it's long been a favorite of mine. And it turns out long a favorite of Greg's, too.
Right.
So.
Melville is known to most Americans because of his novel Moby Dick, which was required reading in many high schools and colleges for a time and probably dreaded by a lot of people because it is so long. I'm curious, has anybody here read Moby Dick?
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody but me. I have to admit.
It's been years.
More than once.
Years
more
for
than
me.
Once. Wow. Wow.
It's a book. I just have to interject this. You just pointed out that's a book that is foisted upon people when they're in high school. And I think people would find it that if they read it after a little bit more lifespan has gone by, they'll find it's a very different book from the one they remembered when they read it at 16, particularly the comedic parts of it. A lot of it is very funny.
Before we go on to his sailing life, what was his background in his early life?
Well, he was born in New York in Lower Manhattan at number 6 Pearl Street, which was a house that was rented by his parents, who were quite well off. His father, Alan, was a merchant, mostly in sort of dry goods imported from France. He would travel back and forth to France, and for a while at least, until Alan went bankrupt in about 1830. They lived very well.
And Melville was taking on jobs at an early age to help support the family, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So when he set out for sea, as you were saying, on the Acushnet. And I think everybody, there's that romance of the sea, right? That idea of seafaring is very romantic. I think until you
have to do it
and you are on the ship. And we know that he and another young man jumped ship in the Marquesas in the South Pacific.
Right.
Other than his fiction, did Melville write about his experiences on the Acushnet, either in diaries or in letters home? Do we have anything about that experience that's not fictionalized?
I don't think so. For those early days, I think you have to try to extrapolate from the early books what his life was like on those ships. The first ship he sailed on was a ship called the St. Lawrence, which sailed from New York to Liverpool. He did that when he was 19, and that formed the basis of a later book. The first book, Typee, that he published, which was dedicated to Lemuel Shaw, was the one about the time when he and Toby Green jumped ship in the Marquesas. And that was the time when he lived for probably about 3 weeks. It turned into 4 months in the book. But he was living among people who might or might not have been cannibals. And so when that book was published, he became known as the man who lived among cannibals. And that was really sort of his image early on. But I think you kind of have to extrapolate from those books what the life was really like. And it's odd because when Typee, for instance, was published, a lot of discussion, it was very, very popular, but it was almost considered a travelogue. And some critics criticized it because they couldn't believe that some of the things he talks about could have actually happened. And Toby Green, who had kind of been out of Melville's immediate orbit for a while, jumped to his defense and said, oh, no, that's what happened. That's exactly what it was like.
Jacqueline, tell us more about the song Little Carrie's Favorite Gallop.
Well, it's a fun song, and I might turn this back over to Greg to talk about the incident that we described with Melville going out on a ride.
Melville was about 40 years old when the Civil War began, and so he was not an active participant in the Civil War, except for one occasion he visited a cousin of his who was a Union Army officer in Northern Virginia, and the concern of the Union Army around that time were the depredations committed on the Union Army by the Confederate Ranger Mosby, who became legendary. With a relatively small band of men, he just wreaked a lot of havoc with the Union Army. He was a guerrilla fighter. And when Melville was down there, there was an expedition to go out to find Mosby. And Herman Melville took part in that expedition. Probably good for the future of American literature that they didn't find Mosby.
And the gallop was a popular ballroom dance of the period. This is from a book that you can find in the Boston Public Library of Howell's Ballroom Dance Manual, and it's been a while since I've read it, but I remember that basically you're in ballroom position with your partner, and you gallop across the floor, almost like dressage, you know, but this is during an era where, you know, they didn't necessarily drink water. It wasn't safe to drink, so other beverages were consumed in the ballroom, and so and women are wearing corsets, and they might faint, so it's pretty shocking to be so vigorous in the ballroom, and you're really just galloping like horses, and the manual says the chief difficulty is to stay on your feet. Well, you know, it's like bumper cars, basically.
Well, with that image in mind, let's give a listen. Melville shared a friendship with the writer Nathaniel Hawthorne. Did Hawthorne play a role in critiquing or promoting Melville's writing? Was he sort of a mentor, or is it really just a friendship?
Mentor is exactly the way that Melville saw Hawthorne. When Melville was living out in Pittsfield, He lived in a house called Arrowhead, which is in the southern part of Pittsfield. And Hawthorne moved out there. He moved out to Lenox and lived in a building, I guess, usually described as the Little Red Cottage, which was on the grounds of what is now Tanglewood. And Melville absolutely sought him out. Melville was highly respectful of Hawthorne and always wanted to create with Hawthorne this deep, soulful fellow feeling, which Hawthorne reciprocated to an extent, but not probably as much as Melville wanted to. But he was Melville was really a fan of Hawthorne's.
After the success of Typee, Melville tried to earn a living as a writer, but it became a struggle for him. How did he support the family? Because he and Lizzie had several children at this point.
They ended up with four children, and probably the chief source of their financial situation was Lemuel Shaw. Shaw really financed them for a long time, and it got to the point where Shaw kind of took it as a credit against Lizzie's inheritance.
Moby Dick was published in 1851, I think.
Right, exactly right.
It didn't become recognized for a great work until after Melville's death. What was the reaction to the book when it was first published?
It was mixed. I mean, a lot of people talk about the very deeply critical pieces about Moby Dick, about how this didn't make any sense. We don't get it. We thought this was going to be a book about whaling, kind of in the same spirit as Typee and Omu and some of the earlier books. And there was a lot more to it, to Moby Dick. But there were some people who did appreciate Moby Dick. Among them was Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman was born in the same year as Herman Melville, and not very far away from where Melville was born. Melville born in New York City. Walt Whitman was born on Long Island. But it didn't do well at all. The interesting thing to note maybe about Moby Dick is how very little money Herman Melville made off of Moby Dick, and the fact that the first edition of Moby Dick was 3,000 copies. Most of them were destroyed in a fire in a warehouse in 1854. There is a first edition of Moby Dick in the Sturgis Library in Barnstable Village, right down the road from the new church, on the same road.
A
lot of people just didn't get it.
As you were saying, thanks to help from his wife's family and friends, they actually help him find a job as a customs official, a post he holds for almost 20 years.
Right.
Not only is this relief for his family financially, it gets Melville out of the house. At this point, he was known for his mood swings, and also he was suffering physically from a road accident and had started drinking. So the last years of his life are not necessarily really happy ones.
No, they're not. A lot of the biographies talk about, you know, they focus on the early days in Polynesia and his sailing adventures and that kind of thing. And then then Moby Dick, of course, and then it kind of fades away. And he's seen as somebody who just sort of moped around. He eventually left the Berkshires, moved back to New York City. And he's painted as this morose figure who just kind of walked around the streets of New York. That's probably overblown. He wasn't quite that misanthropic or solitary. Probably not a happy person. He was very intense. When he got into these books, it was like, okay, you know, don't make any noise, daddy's working kind of thing. Exploded 100 times. You just didn't bother him. He was in his study, probably in Arrowhead, say in the Berkshires, looking at the Mount Greylock out of his window and seeing it as a whale rising above the ocean waves and that kind of thing. But he was intense, and I think the marriage was difficult at times. The marriage did survive, but you're right that the travels and the finances that were being sent his way were sometimes to get him out of the way. He did go on a trip alone, for instance, to Europe and to the Middle East. And that was, I think, largely with the idea of let's get him out of here and see if we can get him straightened out. Mm. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, for instance, was a consul for the American government in England, and the two visited in England. And there were a lot of efforts to try to get him a job along those lines, and they just didn't work out. But they did get him that customs job in New York City.
Jacqueline, there's a reflective piece you're including in the program titled A Psalm of Life. What can you tell us about this?
This is going to be an instrumental version of a song that came down to us through an Indiana singer-songwriter, the melody, but the words were words that Americans learned in school in the 19th century, and I think really up into the 20th century, many Americans learned this wonderful poem by Longfellow, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and it's the words a reaction to the idea of predestination, that people were sorted into heaven or hell, and it was predestined from your birth. And instead, Longfellow is saying, what you do while you live is what matters. Your character is what matters. They seem to match Melville's fervent belief when he talks about the cannibals, the same thing, that and other Polynesian people, that we had such prejudice against them because of the color of their skin or their culture, and that we shouldn't be judging outward things. And so it seemed to have it's not exactly the same sentiments as Longfellow, but it seemed to really work.
Resonate. Okay, let's go listen. Greg, you came across a quote from Herman Melville that gave voice to this notion that it's not really the color of our skin, but really who the character inside that is what's important.
Right.
Can you share that quote with us?
A writing that he did in that book, Redburn, which is the one about the voyage he took to England. And I guess I should say that Redburn, in one of the paperback editions, the cover is by Edward Gorey, whose house is right across the street from New Church. See how these things, it all works together.
I hope you get that first edition copy of Moby Dick in-house for the birthday.
And that would be good. But I talked about the character in Redburn's observations of the African Americans from the ships in England. And there was also another observation that character Redburn makes while he's in Liverpool. And if this one doesn't bring Melville into 2019, I don't know what will. There was hardly anything I witnessed in the docks that interested me more than the German emigrants who came on board the large New York ship several days before their sailing to make everything comfortable ere starting. And among these sober Germans, my country counts the most orderly and valuable of her foreign population. There is something in the contemplation of the mode in which America has been settled that in a noble breast should forever extinguish prejudices or national dislikes. You cannot spill a drop of American blood without spilling the blood of the whole world. Our blood is as the flood of the Amazon, made up of 1,000 currents all pouring into one. We are not a nation so much as a world. We are without father or mother.
Greg Williams and Jacqueline Schwab present Happy 200th Birthday, Herman Melville, Beyond the Whale. That's tonight at 7 at the New Church in Yarmouth Port. Jacqueline, you've selected Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child for us to go out on. What can you tell us about this piece?
It's a spiritual that has always haunted me, and never more so in today's environment. Thinking back to the themes of Civil War, and also that Melville, he enjoyed reading in a library a book of African-American songs. It seemed like very, very fitting. And the nobility of the song and the nobility of the spiritual style. So I couldn't produce Polynesian music myself, but it seemed like that his honoring the nobility of the other.
Jacqueline Schwab and Greg Williams and Marianne Agresti, president of the Yarmouth New Church Preservation Foundation. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and there will be cake.
Oh,
yes, birthday cake.
Thank you so much, Amy. Thank you very much.
I'm Amy Vince. Thanks for listening.